So hi everyone, welcome, and whether you're watching this live, whether you're watching the recording, I hope the next 45 minutes are going to be helpful and interesting for you. I'm going to do my very best to ask the questions that I think you'd like to hear from our esteemed guest, Neerit Cohen, who I'll introduce in a second. But just taking a quick step back, there's so many things I want to try to cover. And if you are live, actually, we'd really like to see your questions as well. If you can pop it into the Q&A, it's a great opportunity to actually quiz Neerit, challenge her. And that, I think challenge is an interesting term as well, because a lot of what we're talking about is theory. We're thinking about what's happening about the future and work in Israel and globally over the next 5 or 10 years. So it is theory. We don't know how it's exactly going to play out. So if you have different opinions, please share those as well. So much to get into, whether it's the culture of Israel. I find Israel a fascinating place because of the success that it's had. It's, of all the nations, probably the one that punches highest above its weight, with such a small number of people, 10 million people, 3 or 4 million people in the workforce. And yes, it's in the top 20 nations for GDP per capita. It's recognized as perhaps the second only to Silicon Valley in the US in terms of its productivity in areas like innovation. Over 100 startups which have now been valued as unicorns. It is a success story of note. So trying to understand the culture of work in Israel, for me, is going to be fascinating. You can probably work out, if you've never listened to me before, I'm English, I'm not from Israel. So it'll be as much as me I can do to try to learn as well. So with that, Neerit, a very warm welcome.
Hello. Hey, Colin. Glad to be here.
Do you want to just kick off a little bit with your experience? I want to word this carefully because I want to say, you know, you've got decades of experience, but that comes across in the wrong way. We're still young at heart, right? But you do, you've got some incredible experiences. We'd like to share those.
Yeah, you know, it's working with the future of work. I always talk to people about how we talk usually about our experience, and we start with saying, here's who I was. And I think what you want to talk about is who you are now and who you're going to be, right? So yes, I am an expert on the future of work. I've been doing this since pretty much 2010. 2020 was the future of work for me for many years before I knew it was going to become that, right? Prior to that, I had worked for almost three decades for Intel in Israel, in Europe, and frankly, globally, including the some corporate jobs. And, you know, here we are.
Tell me about the work culture in Israel as it stands, but not today. Let's say go back to 2018, 2019, because obviously in 2020, we're going to go through that. There's a number of factors which are suddenly impacting. And clearly, again, at the moment, we've got some new factors that we're going to go through. What is the work culture of Israel in general? I know it's a generalism, but let's do our best.
So first of all, you know, we're an island. So as an island, in terms of, you know, most of who you work with and your potential customers and your potential peers are in the world. And so we embrace technology and we embrace everything that opens the world to us. And so, you know, people travel a lot, but then they also look at it from a work perspective and basically say, you know, how do I grow beyond my physical boundaries? And so I think that's an interesting phenomena that worked for us, because it used to be one of those issues, because it was, you know, just kind of this little country, not in the middle of where things happen in terms of the global economy. And we basically needed to break through the boundaries. And so, you know, working through technology, working dispersed, working with diversity, it's a very diverse culture in terms of people come over here from all over the world. So it's something that, you know, you're used to, the idea that you work with people that aren't necessarily who you grew up with. All these elements of work that we consider challenges and we consider, you know, new, for us, they've always been there.
Would you say the work culture, or people at work, employees in general, are resistant to change? Or when you go, because I know you've traveled the world and you've seen, you know, you work in Intel for a long, long time, so you've had plenty of experience dealing with lots of different cultures. Some areas that I've worked in different parts of the world have been quite traditional. I mean, they found it difficult and resistive when change comes along. And we're living in a time when I think, and it's going to come through as changes, it's at it's rates which are truly exponential. You need that workforce which is agile and has the ability to go and effectively take risks to try new things. Do you think that Israelis and the culture in general is resistive to change, or is it actually quite open and can embrace it?
Yeah, first of all, we're a soft hierarchy culture, right? So it's easier to be innovative and push boundaries when you don't have to adhere to hierarchy and adhere to your elders and, you know, all that. So that's actually a very good thing, because in a world that's shifting to networks versus hierarchy, having a soft hierarchy culture is very helpful for us. I think we also are used to the fast pace and the short lived, right? So we start our experience in the work market, and it's going to be sound funny a little bit calling an experience, but you know, many of us start our experience in the work market. Actually, our first job is the Army. Now, you don't necessarily call it a job, but if you just step away for a second, you come out of school and you go to do something in an environment where somebody gives you a role and they tell you what you can and can't do, and they teach you some skills and you gain experience. I mean, these are components of work market, right? And so they're short, they're quick in terms of just you go in and you know that in a couple of years you'll be out. But it prepares you in a certain way for then going into the market and knowing that you can, that you know, that no matter what, you can, right? Because you just did something that comes under the I know I can. And so these are experiences that build the ability to be quicker, be agile, understand that you change, because nobody comes out of the Army and says, okay, I'm going to keep doing the same. You have to redefine who you are professionally. And so you've done that. You've done that at 20 something. Then it shouldn't come as a surprise that you do it again and again and again. And these are all traits of the future of work.
I'm surprised that it's a soft hierarchy culture. I would not have expected that, especially knowing that everyone goes into national service. Armies aren't traditionally known for being flexible, maybe in the field, but the hierarchies are strong, typically.
Yeah, but that's a culture thing.
Yeah,
Colin, you know, and if you go look at global cultures, these are cultural traits. I mean, it goes way back to Israel. I mean, it goes back to the people and where they came from. So it's people in Israel basically come from families who've roamed the world and then came back, right? And so the idea that that you have to adapt to wherever you are and whatever the environment is and then retain kind of a center is something that's in the culture. Also, in the Jewish culture, the idea of asking questions, of not accepting things as they are is very deep-rooted. So children are taught to ask questions very, very early. So the idea that you don't get to say, here's how you do it, go do it, right? Versus here's a thought or a process or an idea, you know, how are we going to go about it? This is deep-rooted in culture.
Mm. Tell me what the average employee thinks about their employer. And what I'm trying to move into is whether there's this feeling that you have to stay with employers for life. I know certainly in my generation, perhaps my parents' generation, we've seen that transition away from, you know, you get your first corporate job and you stay there for the next 30 or 40 years, you know, take the pension and move on. I'm assuming this is far from the truth of how things have been for many years in Israel.
Yes, I think, and I think that's, you know, it's one of the big changes in the world going on for, I think, probably a decade now. We're moving careers, the way they progress are changing, right? When I started out, there was this contract, right, that a career spanned a lifetime. There was like this one big cycle. You learned during your 20s, you set yourself up for a career, you earned the right to call yourself some profession, and then you moved into those, you know, 3-4 decades of work years. And that's when you kind of had to find a good job, preferably a good corporation. You could look at the ladder, you know, could see your boss and their boss and their boss, and you'd see the progression. And all you needed to do was not fall off the ladder, right? Because you know, the organization would train you when you needed, and then the organization would give you a new job and a promotion. And at some point you'd wake up and realize, you know, you're a manager or some professional, and then you coasted to that last phase of your career, which we use to call pension, which is retirement, right? And you do all the fun stuff you never got around to doing, and somebody will pay for that bill. That doesn't work anymore. And so the life cycles for careers are drastically shrinking, which means we need to start, you know, stabilize, drop, and then start another one, which in some cases means rephrasing who we are. It means relearning new skills or unlearning old ones, changing maybe employers, sometimes changing a way of employment, maybe doing dual careers, you know, maybe more things at a time. And so that shrinking requires us to change the way we are. And I think we're in the middle of this period where a lot of people, definitely my generation, are struggling because that's not what we signed up for, and we should be coasting right now. And the rules have changed. I think the younger generation, they realize that. So they're looking at us, and we still tell them, you know, go get a good education and go work at a good employer. And they're looking at us and saying, well, it didn't work out for you, did it? So, you know, we're figuring it out, but there aren't many role models.
Let's switch gear. Let's start talking about some of these global mega trends. What are the major trends that you're seeing that are impacting already today?
So I think first of all, it's time to stop saying post-COVID, right? It's not like the future of work has arrived. It hasn't. It gets created every day again, right? Mm-hmm. So COVID was definitely a very big game changer. Pushed us forward many years at a time. So in this leaps and bounds in terms of our need to get used to technology, a lot of industries that, you know, we're not used to communicating virtually and globally, the idea that we can work from anywhere, that work isn't a place you go to, but something you do, that opens up possibilities. It opens up possibilities for people to actually go find employment in ways they couldn't, you know, think about before. It also opens up possibilities for people to live in different places, to think in different ways about potential employers. And then reverse is true, right? Employers can think in different way about the possibilities of access to talents instead of who's here, right? You say who's out there and, you know, how do I engage with them? And so COVID was an excellent gym, I like to call it, where you actually have to flex these muscles because not because you know, some people like it, but some people just go because we know it's good for us. And so it's really about building the strength to be able to employ people in a new way, to access talent in a new way, to motivate and engage people in a new way. These are all great. But it doesn't stop there, right? That's just kind of how we got to here. We're also seeing, we're actually seeing these really big mega trends happening right now. One coming out of really the people experiences of the last few years, which really changes expectations and what people want. We see, you know, a huge change of contract in terms of how work fits into my life and how life fits into my work. Then there's this other, you know, whole set of megatrends that I will lump together for a second and say, we call it technology, right? It's what is possible. It's what you can do. It's what you're going to have to do differently. And coming together, they're going to change the environment for us.
Are you net positive on these changes in terms of the impact?
So, you know, I used to go into some of these future of work keynotes, and people would start getting angry about slide 3, right? And I would have to stop. And so I learned to preface these talks, and I'd say, you know, I'm not here telling you, hey, look, it's a really wonderful world. You know, I'm just here to tell you it is what it is. And so the question isn't whether you like it or not. It's whether you're going to understand and adapt and ask yourself, you know, how am I going to turn it into what I need it to be. So we used to have these questions about, will technology replace us, right? That's not the right question. It's people using technology will replace the people who are not using technology, right? People who can work regardless of place will be better off than people who are waiting for some gatekeeper to hire them into some job, right? So the idea is not good or bad. It's really about, here's the environment, and are you learning what's changing? And then are you asking yourself, where does it affect me? Is it either skills that I need to create? Am I, you know, learning, unlearning, relearning? We used to depend on our employers to teach us. I actually talked about this a few days ago in a keynote when Windows started, and I'm sorry, but I'm old enough to remember before there was Windows, right? So when Windows started, we had so much time that we took months to bring people into conference rooms and teach them, you know, Windows and Office. Mm. And ChatGPT, if you stop looking at the feed of what it means and the prompts and the tools, you know, 2 weeks, you're completely out of date, right? And we can't rely on our employers to teach us anymore. We have to stay relevant. We have to put aside time and budget and attention to make sure that we reskill ourselves all the time.
Okay, so this is a really interesting transition. Now, let's just use the counter argument. So over in the US, companies like JP Morgan, even some of the big tech firms, are taking a stance that they want their employees back at work. So going back to what you said about this transition is work, something you do rather than somewhere that you go to. And obviously, we've always had it as somewhere you go to, in my mind, because we didn't have this technology. So if you wanted to organize something, you had to get your people together in one central type of location. You also get the other benefits from economics in theory, where you have groupings of industries and clusters closely proximated together. So you're able to go and benefit from employees, in this case, transitioning from organization to organization with similar skills, certainly in the sector that I come from. That's the Jamie Dimon sort of view, and I can see where he's coming from. What's your view, and where do you think it's going? Do you think that's out of date and that they'll get left behind
as
we see the remote workforce?
Thank you for that question, because it's one of the biggest misconceptions out there. So let's go back to those headlines, right? The headlines that you quoted, many of them come from multinational companies based in the US. And the US is very big. By the way, this problem also happens in a lot of Asia, right? Not in Israel, and I'll explain. They're not bringing people back to work. They're bringing people back from fully remote to part-time in the office. Under every single one of those headlines, the only two exceptions I found to date was Disney, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the second one, that actually talked about 5 days a week, right? But all those headlines, when they're calling people back, they're calling them back to two to three days in the office. And the reason that's, you know, making so much headline is because in the US, when people, they actually moved away from the centers of where these employers are. And so you can't commute to work 2 to 3 days. So you have to actually move your life back to a different location to be able to come in to 2 to 3 days. That's not the situation in Israel. And it's also, and I think it's really damaging to keep harping at this idea that they're reversing on hybrid. They're not. These are companies that didn't even allow a day of work from remote before COVID, that are now negotiating people from full-time to, you know, 2 to 3 days in the office. So I think it's important to understand you cannot move into the future with a view into the rear mirror. It doesn't work that way. There's no go. Anything that starts with the world going back is not possible. And what we're really seeing is a really strong struggle, valid one, right? To figure out, how do we do business? How do we engage people? How do we motivate? How do we manage work? You know, how do we do all this if we're not physically together? Because we're used to, for the past, you know, few hundred years, work was a place. And so our friends were from work because we spent most of our waking hours at that building, right? So now when you look at data, and a lot of work moved to digital space, we can actually look at data, you see that the behavior of work is changing. The days get longer. There's a three peak kind of day. They're not 9 to 5. They're spread differently. People are taking longer breaks. They're working differently. The weeks get shorter. People start later. in the first day of the week. They end earlier on the last day. They're building out the way they work in a different way. And managers don't know, because nobody taught us, to be fair, right? We've spent decades teaching managers how to manage, and these tools are not working anymore. New tools. And so the easy way out is to say, it's not working, let's bring them back to the office. It's not going to work. People are voting with their feet. The great resignation numbers in 2022 were larger than the great resignation numbers when they started, right? People are voting with their feet. They're actually talking about, we see a lot of kind of future less work activities going out there. So people want a different way to balance work and life, life and work. They want more autonomy. We need to figure out new ways to make sure they understand what success looks like, engage them.
Let's dig into that. I mean, there's probably three things I'm interested in to get your views on, and let's break them down as the company side of things and the kind of risks and issues of this hybrid model, and then the individual side of things in terms of the impacts on ourselves. The corporate one is kind of like a 1A, 1B. The first problem that you've got is this proximity bias, where as a manager, when you're sitting in office, and often it is the senior leadership that feel they have to go into the office, therefore they set the trend. And whether we like it or not, there is a strong correlation between those people that are closest to you, that you interact with most, that you build trust up with, that you end up promoting. It's really sad to say, but that is a bias that is extremely difficult to stamp out of an organization. Along comes the hybrid model, and it makes it exponentially harder to manage that, because you've got a workforce that is sitting there remote or in a hybrid space, and your close friends sitting with you, forming relationships in the office. There's a clear advantage for the people that are turning up into the office. How do you think companies can go about managing that, or is it actually impossible? And then the second part to it is related, is how do you actually ensure that you manage the productivity of your staff? Because again, it was easy in the office environment. Busy bees are typing on their computers. They're coming in before the boss, leaving after the boss. You see where they park, you see what they wear, you make opinions about what they're doing, and you sit in lots and lots of meetings, particularly for those organizers, not the specialists. If I'm a coder or I'm a programmer, maybe this is less relevant, but the majority of staff who are organizing other people to do things for that organization. Now, they're not visible, you can't see, and they're the glue that holds organizing, or rather the oil perhaps is a better analogy in terms of the progress. And again, it's very difficult to now make an assessment about their productivity. So what's your view on those two issues, this proximity bias and understanding productivity, and what corporate should do about it? I know they're difficult questions. I'll say that in advance.
So first of all, proximity bias existed prior to hybrid and COVID. And for countries like Israel and many of the countries in the regions, right, we were the first ones to suffer from proximity bias, because proximity actually meant walking the corridors of headquarters somewhere in the US. And so what we would spend our time doing is actually traveling to headquarters so that our face and names were recognized. One of the interesting learnings from COVID that actually works really great for dispersed organizations, which again is not a hybrid concept, right? They existed before. Any multinational, anyone working in a multinational knows what that means, is that suddenly we've actually leveled the playing field between global and headquarters. And so there was a lot of proximity bias that is now working in favor of countries that are remote to the centers of corporations. So that's kind of something to understand. And so growing your skills and capabilities, and like you said, I worked for almost three decades, right, for Intel. Many of those years, by definition, you know, being what's called remote. And so we develop skills to actually influence and build relationships and become impactful without actually walking the corridors. And these are skills that, again, they're not new. They've just been kind of only relevant to people who have worked in dispersed organizations before. So that's kind of one thing. I think the idea is that we need to teach people how to become impactful and how to become seen and how to build relationships and most of all, trust, right? From remote. And so the proximity bias, frankly, I don't buy it, because the data shows that people are not showing up, even though corporations are asking them to show up, you know, for 3 days, they're not. They're coming in because we're social beings. We like people, right? But they're not coming in. They're coming in to interact, not to sit in their, you know, cubicle and headphones and kind of do work on a screen. I'm talking about, obviously, knowledge workers, right? Neither are the managers. And even if they are coming in more than the employees, they're not seeing their entire team there at the same time. They're kind of seeing them in different ways. And so I actually think that what's happening is it's the reverse of proximity bias. It's we're growing the skills to connect via other means. And I also think technology will help because it's going to figure it out. I think that's, you know, that's a short-term situation of where we're still relying on those tools and skills that we accumulated in the last decades of training in the workplace. And once we let those go, we'll actually realize that the world has opened up and we can work with people on a much more leveled playing field than we did before. By the way, we also see it from data on business travel, which hasn't bounced back.
Interesting. Now that sounds positive. I know that you said on slide 3, you have to be careful. What about the productivity side of things, though, in terms of being able to adequately measure? And where I'm going here is that we all aspire to be working for or running a Netflix type organization where, you know, they famously take away the HR holiday policy and really focus on trying to promote and reward people based on what they bring to the organization. In simple terms, if you can do amazing things one day a year, just work for us for one day a year. We don't need to micromanage you in terms of the numbers of hours. That's a pipe dream for most organizations. And now it's even harder because they've been using very standard KPIs and other measures to try to understand the benefits of their people to their productivity. And they're suddenly working all over the place and they can't even see them to make incorrect decisions at scale. How is that going to be managed going forward?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And, you know, you reminded me that I think back in 2011 or 12, The Economist had an article. I had the picture up on a lot of my slides for many years. They called it Workers on Tap. So the idea that the future organization, and we're talking over a decade ago, right, will just bring the right people at the right time in the right place to do the right work. And then you don't really need to have your people. And I think we're actually seeing this unbundling of work happening for over a decade. We just haven't been paying attention. So the question of do you own the people or do you find the right people, bring them in whatever form works for you for whatever project and time, and can you engage them? And so the productivity metrics of how we were used to measuring, first of all, relied on the fact that we were there physically. And frankly, we measure what's easy to measure, not necessarily what is the right thing to measure, because sometimes the right things are hard. And so when you move from work as a place you go to something you do, you have to start measuring less of where and when and how people are, you know, operating, and more about what they're delivering, you know, what the quality is, how good it is. And I like to take it to the extreme and I ask management, right? If I gave you a choice between a person that could do, you know, twice as much work in half the time, or a person, kind of your standard person, standard structure of, you know, this is a job, this is a roles and responsibilities, what would you choose to do? And the logical thing is to say, of course, I'll take the person that can do twice. But then we say, but if they can do twice, right? Have them do three times. If they're working half the time, have them work full time for me. But the person says, I want this to be a win-win. I'm going to give you twice as much productivity and half the time. The other half belongs to me. You don't get to own all of my time, just because somewhere in the past we used to define a work day as an 8-hour, you know, 40 something work week. So I think productivity needs to shift to stop measuring clicks or time or, you know, attendance or anything input and measure output and start asking, you know, what is it that I want this person to deliver? And which, by the way, goes back to the remote conversation there. Am I communicating it? You know, are we aligned of what success looks like, how you're getting measured? You know, who is to say, do you know how to raise flags when something gets in the way? So all these tools that cause us to be able to the workflow to flow, and then for us to measure the workflow as opposed to measuring the input.
Now, you talk about networks. Let's go on to networks, because when I think about remote work and then we think about networks and networking, and lots of people describe it in different ways. Some talk about this move towards agile as a first step, or scrum, and then you can move into even more extreme variations like holacracy, which is often linked to companies like Zappos. They're all saying the same thing, giving complete autonomy to groupings of people with different structures to try to manage that at scale. You've got these types of extremes. Other books talk about it in colors. You've got books that talk about moving from red to green organizations and setting hierarchy. And then you go from green to teal, which are fascinating in terms of, again, setting up autonomy for staff. So the thought leaders in this space, whether it's coming from Harvard, whether it's coming from well-respected authors and business leaders, is always about flattening hierarchies, giving more autonomies to your teams. And it makes a lot of sense, because you then get better, faster decision making in theory across your organization. This moment in time seems to be driving this faster in terms of adoption because of the hybrid models that we're seeing. This is going to cause huge angst and fear for a lot of the existing managers that have been used to owning their federations and having large hierarchies, because their sense of relevance is suddenly being ripped away from them and they're going to fight back. What's your view in firstly, the opening hypothesis that in general these are good models for organizations, and then B, the kind of transition to them and the difficulties companies might face?
You know, we've been talking and struggling with networks for quite some time now. We have been seeing them grow. We see them grow in the macroeconomics, because we see, if you go back to the 2008 of economic downturn, when we came out of that, the headlines called it jobless recovery. Because the way we think of how downturns reverse themselves is growth in job. But we saw growth without jobs. Now, growth without jobs is networks, because it's people interacting in structures that are not an organization created jobs, and that's how they create value. It's basically, I know how to do something, you need it, and we find a way to communicate and exchange value, right? So we've been watching this. We also see double-digit growth in people in organizations of 1 to 3 in the last decade, right? So networks have been growing. We also see them growing inside organizations. If about 2-3 decades ago, most of my work was managed by my manager, most of the people I worked with or interacted with were my peers in the org chart. And if I was a manager, these were people I deployed, right? Today, most people operate within organizations in a number of teams that, you know, their manager doesn't necessarily manage the work. Sometimes I form a team, I lead a team, I join a team, I leave a team, right? A consultant team from the outside. And so those are networks. Thing about networks is you can't manage them. You need to enable them. So it goes back to tools. It's that needing to teach managers to engage people, to know what's going on, to design the workflow separately from managing the people, right, and growing them. It's actually separation of managing people and managing work, and they're operating in a different way. And so enabling networks requires a lot of letting go, but it also requires being really clear about what are we creating, you know, engaging people, not in the to-do list, not the IMBOs, right? Not the what you used to do. Here's your IMBO and success factors for the next year. Those don't work anymore. It's really about, what are we doing? How do you connect the dots? Do you understand the relationship between your role and somebody else's in the bigger picture? Can you self-correct, right? Can you self-manage? And so networks require different skills from us. They require different skills from managers. They require different metrics. And what we're still trying to do is control them.
The metrics part is very interesting. I mean, one way to enable managers to move away from managing or directing to enabling is you have to change how their incentives are structured, potentially one of them being whereby the people that they're trying to enable become the voters in what they should be paid or whether they should be promoted. So it's almost a reverse hierarchy model. That's just one example. Are you seeing other cool ways that incentives and metrics are changing, try to accelerate moving some of the more traditional leaders into more enabling positions?
Yeah, yes. I think if you look at how managers are managing people, we used to select managers based on excellence in whatever core expertise of work was. So it's more the hard skills, right? Then we teach them the soft skills. But we don't really, certainly not pay, and I don't even know if meritocracy and promote and all that around how they're managing and how they're enabling. Some of the interesting metrics that you can see today is actually tracking of lateral movements. We know managers are one of the biggest barriers of the organization of getting the right people into the right jobs. Because if you manage me, right, and I want to go do something else that might be more important to the company, but you're not, it's not your, you know, you don't get any credit, you're not going to let me. But for the company, it's the right thing to do to have me move to where I'm contributing to the most of my ability on the most important stuff right now. Managers are barriers to this. And so starting to actually measure in the organization, all the way down to the individual manager, the ability of people or the agile organization, I call it, right? The ability to move the right person to the right task is an extremely important. Another really interesting one is training. We keep talking about the importance of training, but we don't measure or incentivize people for training. We measure and incentivize them for productivity. Now, training isn't productivity. Training is being prepared for tomorrow's productivity. But if we keep measuring you on, you know, the lines of code that you generate or whatever it is that you do, right? Why would you ever take time out to go train yourself for being able to do the line of codes in tomorrow's tools or better or faster? That's another one. These are hard, but they're also what you need to start thinking about if you want to shift direction.
Now, everyone's going to be very disappointed with me if I don't at least ask some sort of question related to ChatGPT and generative language models in general. So I'm going to start off with a view and then see what yours is. My personal view is that we shouldn't be fearful of ChatGPT. If you were, and I'm not talking about all the downside scaremongering and risk, which may or may not be accurate. I'm just talking about simple issues around it in terms of productivity. Is it going to take or create jobs? And my view is I can't imagine a time where humans are ever going to have everything they want and everything that they need. Our thirst for stuff is just infinite. And so whatever productivity tool we create, whether it's farming hundreds of years ago or ChatGPT now, we will create the demand and the productivity will have to increase. And therefore, we will use these tools and generate new roles. And even just existing roles are going to go from, I don't know, let's use a simple example. If I'm a marketeer and I was doing one blog a day, now I'm doing 30 blogs a day, but so is everybody else. And so we're going to end up actually just putting perhaps more hours in to be competitive with these tools than we had. That's my view. What's your view about the impact of ChatGPT, and perhaps more importantly, how organizations should be, you know, dealing with this, because it is obviously transformative?
Yes, you know, so I'm trying to think from where to start. First of all, it begins with the idea that, you know, when the iPhone was introduced by Steve Jobs in 2007, the next day, it wasn't headlines. It was headlines in tech sectors of newspapers, right? But we all know that the iPhone or the idea of the smartphone didn't change tech. It changed our lives and the way we work and think and operate and play and communicate. I think ChatGPT is similar. So it's still kind of this tech concept, but it's not. It's not. I can tell you about myself, since I work with in future trends all the time. I force myself to stay updated. And part of it is realizing that you really have to stay on top, because the changes are so quick that, you know, if I'm on vacation for a week and I come back, there's like, I'm way behind. But it's more than that. I write weekly in a paper, the newspaper in Israel, and The Marker every Wednesday on the future work. Have been doing that for almost a decade. And I used to translate my columns to English and publish them in English. And that took a lot of time. And as of ChatGPT, I've been publishing them in dual languages in real time. And now for me, it's a huge productivity boost. Now, nobody taught you to do that. There's no course. Employers or, you know, Udemy, but you have to figure it out. So the idea of technology will change your jobs assumes that there's a limited amount of productivity in the world. And if technology will do more, we will have less. First of all, maybe there's going to be more time for other stuff. You know, that might not be a bad thing, but that's also hasn't been the history. The history has always been that technology comes in and it grows what's possible and new things emerge. So I don't think it's about you wrote one blog, now you're going to write 30 and everybody's going to write 30. And I ask myself, what's the value of blogs if technology wrote it, right? But but I think the idea is, it's like the word processor replaced the typewriter. But we can do so much more with Office today that wasn't possible when the typewriter was there. So I think we don't understand yet the so much more we'll do, but it's not going to take years. It's really going to grow very fast. So the question we all should be asking ourselves, what is this thing? Do I have it open? Am I exploring? Am I, you know, putting aside time and budgets and attention so that I can learn what's relevant for me? And then How do you create something new? How does it open possibilities for you? Same thing as managers, right? Are you thinking about how these things are going to disrupt or enable what you're doing, how you're communicating? All these questions are up for grabs right now.
Right. We've got 1 minute. I'm going to ask one question. This is the hardest question I think you'll ever been given. With your decades of experience, with the writings and thought that you put into your articles and your predictions about what's happening in the future, if you could just choose one recommendation, this is the hard bit, for senior leaders and for HR executives to focus on, what would be the one recommendation you'd give them?
I've been asked this so many times, I actually have a 1 minute answer. Organizations take a long time to change. People change quicker. So the more you can give the direct managers flexibility within a framework to do the right thing at the right time with the right person in the right circumstances, the faster you will discover you're able to shift your organization to where it needs to be. It won't work if you're trying to manage it from the top. But if you're really giving your managers the ability and the tools to do the right thing, they know what that is, and they will shift the organization for you.
What a great answer. What a great way to end a call, which unfortunately was far too short. Nirit, I'd like to thank you very much for joining me. I'd like to thank everyone else for listening in on the call, whether that be live or recorded. I'd also like to thank Atlas for sponsoring these sessions and allowing us to learn and debate about what the future of work is going to be like. If you want more information about how they can help you with remote workforces, then obviously drop them a line. I'm sure that everyone here has got the mailers, and if you can't find it, I'm sure you can reach out to Nirit or myself on LinkedIn, and we'll definitely put you in contact. So with that, thank you very much, and I wish you all a safe and great day, week, month, and rest of the year. Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.